Red Eye is a program of alternative politics and culture which broadcasts live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM and around the world at cooperadio.org. Here's Lorraine Chisholm.
Rain Songs of Kotli is a book of linked short stories set in a small town in Pakistan, just a few miles from the border with India. Author Tariq Malik grew up in Kotli, then moved to Kuwait, where he lived and worked for 20 years. Tariq came to Canada 10 years ago. Rain Songs of Kotli is his first book, and he joins me in the studio to talk about it this morning. Good morning, Tariq.
Good morning, Lorraine.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, tell me about the Kotli, the town where these stories are set.
Kotli is currently, it's just a routine, a regular kind of a town that dot most of Pakistani Punjab. But the time that the book is set in was a very tumultuous time for the inhabitants of that area, because the town was beginning to break apart. People were leaving, and the town was it appeared as if it would disappear into history at that time.
Now, it was historically, I understand, an ironworking town?
Yeah, these were metal craftsmen, and they have a 400 to 500 year history of metal craftsmanship. And that was not the only thing. This town was distinct in the sense that they had an extremely good quality of craftsmanship, due to which they were famous all over the place. Mm-hmm. And that's what put
it. Now, you write in your book that more than two-thirds of the inhabitants leave the town within a generation. What prompted that exodus?
Mostly it was the industrial age, which caught up with Pakistan, I think, in the late 50s. It was also mass production, the age of plastic, in which craftsmen could no longer play a relevant role. And since these people were mostly working with their hands, there was no longer a need to supply those items which they were good at making. Mm. So they moved away to other industrial areas where their skills could be better utilized.
I understand that your family still lives there.
My mother lives there and my sisters. My father passed away very early. And that's what prompted, like everyone else, like most of the youth out there, for me to move on. I went to Kuwait, and that's where I was working for 20 years.
Now, the book itself is set, as you said, at a tumultuous time. It's in the 1950s, which is 10 years after the partition of India. The first story in the book deals with a family that's split apart by partition. Is the story of this family typical of what happened in Kotli during that period?
Yes, it is. At the time, like I was telling Jane, that there were very few families at that time who did not lose a member or a family member during those tumultuous times. And it was just the residue of that one traumatic event which still 10 years later was so powerful in influencing the lives of these people, which is why I chose that time for my book.
Now, I understand that this little town was part of Imperial India that became Pakistan. What was the effect of that for the people who lived in the town?
I doubt if it had any impact at the time. For independence to impact on a backdoor some village in the distance, it would take a long time. So the partition itself had an impact, but the leaving of the change of guard, as it is, of the government, didn't really impact on these tiny villages.
Now, I understand that the wife in this story in the book is a Sikh living in her old house, and she's married to a Muslim who appropriated the house after a partition, and no one knows she's from the family that used to live there. How does that story unfold?
The story was basically based on a germ of an idea. It's based on partial truth, in which there is a rumor that two Sikhs came back a few years after the partition to reclaim something they'd hidden in a ceiling of their house. And there was this owner, the new owner, who had been living in this house and staring at the ceiling for ages, intending to go up there and fix the ceiling someday, because there was a bulge up there, and he thought it's a defect in the system, in the roof as it is. And so that was the germ of the idea. And I took that idea and built up upon that to arrive at this story. I tried to give it several layers of reality, because it begins as a dream.
Ah.
And most readers have had have had their own interpretation of exactly what happens in the book, in this story, especially this story.
Now, understand that your family is Muslim, so they didn't have to flee at this historic time. What did partition mean for them?
It was still traumatic because of all the turmoil around them and the tragedies that were unfolding with their neighbors. They had lived all these centuries with the Hindus and the Sikhs, and suddenly your neighbors and your friends and the people you integrated with were suddenly your enemies. So it did have an impact, although they were often not the victims of the turmoil.
So in a sense, it was traumatic for the entire population.
Yes, it was, definitely. It's so traumatic that you can see even now India and Pakistan, after all these years, after 55 years of separation, they still have this extremely, extremely antagonistic relationship, and they're not able to overcome.
Is its position near the border with India and Pakistan, does that have an effect on the politics of the area?
Politics of this place, yes, definitely. It's so close to the border. During the last war that Pakistan and India had, I think in 1971, in which Bangladesh was formed, I could sit on my rooftop in Kotli and look across at Jammu and see the war unfolding across the border.
Mm.
So it's that close to the borderline,
the
town itself. So which is why when the partition took place, it was right at the forefront. And there are claims that up to 2 million people died within a 50-mile radius of that town.
Wow. Many people left Kotli to work in the Gulf States, as you did, and as one of the characters, Shafiq, does. And he becomes very disillusioned there. Why does he come to dislike Kuwait so much?
Shafiq, like most of us who go to these places, go there with a lot of illusions. Delusions, rather. They're out there for a better world, a better life, and to develop their professional selves. What Kuwait does is, I've been comparing it to a modern slave camp, where you work, you have no rights whatsoever, and you keep working there until you drop dead or literally are exhausted, and then you come back home, and then you try and reclaim your lives, which you can't do because you've lived all this time outside. And Shafiq is a typical example. It's basically my own life. There's a lot of autobiographical material in there. All of his Kuwait experience is mine.
Hmm. Now, I understand that that this character, Shafiq, dies in a shipwreck on his way home from Kuwait. And the shipwreck itself is actually a real event. It was a disaster that involved a great loss of life for people. Why did you want to include this in that story?
I think his death defines his life also. It defines the tragedy also, that here was someone who had gone out with an intent to create something for his family, and he was returning and he died in this thing. So to me, there's a lot of pathos in this. It also defines the desperation of these people to venture out. I begin the story with him having some trepidations about venturing outside across the ocean. And then ultimately, of course, the ocean claims him.
Mm. Now, you said that it was based a lot on your own experience. Is that character, Shafiq, based on your life?
No, Shafiq isn't me. I've tried to project my own character, what I would have been 10 years later if I was elder and all this thing.
Interesting. Now, one of the stories deals with a marriage between a young woman and an older man, and the man beats his wife. Was this a common occurrence when you were growing up?
It's not that common, but it is tended... I mean, it's something that's not openly discussed. It's part of the, I suppose, part of the culture that's not brought out openly.
Why did you decide to explore that in your story?
It's something, most of my characters are empowered women, and I wanted, I love this song, which is Mitti Da Bawa. It's a very resonant song, and I based my story based on this song itself. So the song was the point from which we launch our story. And it again unfolds in three stages in which this woman is slowly, slowly growing out of her childhood and becoming a woman and being empowered in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Go
ahead.
The idea was that she would eventually overpower the person who is abusive towards her and emerge as an equal partner.
Now, so I understand that at the end of the story, the husband is on his way home, and she's waiting for him with a rolling pin. Now, is that a likely scenario?
That gives away the punchline.
Oops.
The idea was that I wanted some kind of resonant moment in which you could illustrate that she's finally on equal footing, and she's waiting there. That if he does anything, here I am, ready to defend myself.
And so, so it's great. It's a great idea for a story. At the end of I think maybe what we'll do now is we'll ask you to read a passage from the book, and maybe you could introduce this passage and set it up for us. I understand it's from the final story, Malhara Moving to the Sound of Water.
This is towards the end of the story, and it's based on the story began. The book began with the beginning of drought, and we're coming to the conclusion of the book, which is the coming rain. Emerging from the masjid under the harsh, bright noon sky, we immediately began scanning the skies for signs of cloud cover. And during the first night, some of us took to climbing atop our rooftops to gaze longingly at the faint, distant flicker of lightning as it flashed tantalizingly at the base of the foothills to the north. Sometimes a moist, teasing breeze would even carry the faint drum roll of a thundercloud. The tantalizing glimpse of that distant rainstorm now began to percolate into the landscape of all our shared dreams. But our patience was to be tempted for one more week, and then we would awaken one final dawn to the searing crackle and sizzle of overhead lightning, and the sight of her sky smeared grey as if by a dirty cotton rag. And on this day, the muezzin ascending the rickety ladder to the top of the masjid to sound the azan would lose his voice and end up instead beating in his excitement the tambura with both his bare hands. Our world was now to be rudely shaken and rearranged by forces we believed we had unleashed upon ourselves. The first signs of the coming turbulence are the rustling of grasses. Overhead static jumps from charge to charge, a flickering, quivering flame that leapfrogs from one density to another of condensed vapor, alive and restless, fickle, favoring a node here, a spark there. The mass of clouds collide like giant brimstones. The resounding crackle and its reverberations fade away gradually. The prayed-for maelstrom that had percolated through our collective dreams and of which Malhara had had us dream for so long had finally arrived. Standing idly for once at the periphery of the pool and anxiously contemplating the effectiveness of his recently completed task, Malhara also welcomes the approaching storm. The humid wind has picked up the scent of the wilting transplanted rice shoots. In the shade of the bulrushes and reeds, the famished catfish wriggle deeper into the oozing mud. A solitary stalk alights from the shade of the poolside kicker with barely a wing beat and briefly chases its reflection across the reflected sky of the shriveled pool. Malhara recalls a dream of floating shorebirds. The blades of grass stir underfoot and shed some of their powdery coating of dust. By now, the horizon in the distance is a blur of motion that is rapidly sweeping forward. Craning his neck to get a better view of the ragged layers of clouds racing overhead, Malhara feels a dizzying disorientation, a sensation one gets when looking down from a boat or a bridge, and the rushing waters below seem to be standing still while you race over them. The commotion around him is momentarily hushed, the moistness of the mud smelled and tasted before the first signs of the darkening earth are actually seen. Then the onslaught begins in earnest. The first splotches of dark tan mark the ground at his feet. Instead of turning away and hurrying to take shelter, he eases himself out of his clothes. Uninhibited for once, he plants his feet firmly against the wind and reaches upwards with his raised arms, as if tempting the distantly crackling flashes to find him. He is greeted by a deafening roar that makes his statically charged hair stand on end as droplets the size of fingernails pelt his weathered, upturned face, his pale shoulders, the tanned skin of his forearms, his sun-bleached hair. Wherever the droplets crash into the powdered dry earth, they send up miniature mushrooms of dust that rapidly lose their individuality in the uniformity of mud. In a short while, the crackled texture of slush has merged deeply, completely into a smoothly churned and homogeneous layer that has the consistency of butter. The rain now descends as sheets of glass, and wherever there was air, there is now only water. A million bejeweled crowns erupt to dimple the surfaces of the impromptu lakes that have become seething cauldrons. Rivulets pool and overflow their natural barriers, and with the sluice gates finally set fully open, the brick walls of the houses are stained a deep ochre and the mildew left in sharp contrast. The overflow overwhelms the drains.
That's beautiful writing. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask you, this is your first book, and it takes you takes you back to your roots. What are you thinking of for the future in terms of your writing?
I'm working up. When I came here 10 years ago, I saw that I was amazed to find that there are so many Punjabis out here, and there's actually a Punjabi culture out here. So I started reading up on it, and I found out a very interesting period which begins at the early part of the 20th century, especially the events of 1914. And I'm doing research in my next book, Chanting the Denied Shore, is based on those events.
Well, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you this morning. Thank you for coming in and reading.
Thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed this.
I've been speaking with Tariq Malik. He's the author of Rain Songs of Kotli, which was published last year by Tsar Press.
You've been listening to Red Eye, a program produced by an alternative media collective in Vancouver, Canada. Red Eye broadcasts live every Saturday morning from 9 until noon and can be heard around the world at cooperadio.org.